Good morning, Mr. Hennessy.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors.
Or good afternoon.
I think it is.
It is.
It's been a long morning. I hate to be on the tail end of it, but...
No. We'll treat you with exactly the same kindness that we treated almost everyone else.
I'm happy to be in your court for the first time today. It's an honor to be here. My name is Miles Hennessy. I represent Mr. McGowan, who suffered convictions for wire fraud and fraud by an investment advisor. I am from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and may it please the Court and Counsel, I'd like to proceed now. Your Honors, this case represents a challenge under the Confrontation Clause and under Rule 804 of the Federal Rules of Evidence to the District Court's determination of unavailability to the chief and to the most crucial witness in this trial, and involves a factual situation and backdrop that I don't believe this Court has yet encountered in its jurisprudence on this point specifically.
I have a question for you, though, as you get started on this point. Was there any objection made that any of the particulars of Rule 15, Criminal Rule 15, were not complied with respect to these various depositions that happened?
Your Honor, I believe that the video deposition would comply with Rule 15, but for one important component that I wish to address in a little bit, and that is the tremendous period of time that passed between the primary taking of this deposition that supposedly sufficed for cross-examination and the actual trial. 80% of it was conducted in 2004, and trial actually took place in January 2007. But I think technically under the rule, the video deposition would suffice.
All right. But if that's the case, then our decision in the United States against Cannon seems to indicate that if the technical requirements of Rule 15 are satisfied, then there is no Confrontation Clause problem.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that the technical components of any presentation of substitute testimony, and that is what we have here. We have obviously not the witness, but a video of it, must primarily be addressed from the standpoint of whether the right of confrontation was proper and full and complete. That is sort of the essence of the rejuvenated Confrontation Clause post-Crawford.
No, I understand that, but Cannon is a 2008 post-Crawford decision, and it says, and I'm quoting, there's no reason to question the constitutionality, that would be the Confrontation Clause issue, of admitting fully cross-examined testimony preserved by a properly conducted Rule 15 deposition, because the rule requires the presence of the defendant, requires full cross-examination. All of those things, as far as I can tell from this record, happened here.
Your Honor, the key word there is fully, and one of the primary points that we need to make is that in 2004, when this started, the discovery process was tainted and flawed, as was found by the district court judge, which justified a continuance on the day of trial just 2 years later, Your Honor, when the jury was brought in. Everyone was ready to go. Limited recross-examination was supplied, Your Honor.
Judge Grady seemed to have been bending over backwards to try to make sure that you had as full access as possible to Ms. Lemie.
Well, Your Honor, I would dispute that a little bit, because the order that Judge Grady issued, which allowed the second deposition, which would have been in December of, I believe, 2005, Your Honor, actually very specifically limited counsel to specific areas, which upon arrival in North Carolina, it was learned were deficient, but counsel made it a point not only then, but later in dealing with hearings at which it was discussed, pointed out that he, you know, struggled to adhere to the court's ruling because he was there in South Carolina and had so many other things that he thought was pertinent to talk about, but he was essentially curtailed by the judge, and that was the end of that. Of course, he followed the judge's order.
Did he try at the time to contact the judge by telephone or in any other way get an expansion?
Your Honor, now, of course, it's difficult not having been trial counsel,
sure.
But my recollection is that there was a communication to at least the assistant U.S. attorney at the time that this was inadequate and that there might well have been some contact or effort to reach the court. But Your Honor, I can certainly look into the record and answer that question separately if you want. But Your Honor, clearly the confrontation clause does apply to instances where face-to-face communication with a or face-to-face opportunity to question an accuser in court doesn't happen. And I understand the court's point about the Cannon case, but if there are deficiencies in this cross-examination process, I don't know if the court will find another case where cross-examination was primarily almost 3 years ago. And it affects a lot of things as a trial lawyer. It certainly affects the theme of cross-examination. You're missing documents which are of core importance, documents which, I might add, counsel had specifically requested by a letter ahead of the very first deposition in 2004, and those were handwritten interactions between Ms. Lemie and the FBI, things upon which he sought to accomplish a number of things in cross-examination that could have been accomplished the morning trial started in 2007.
Now, you did not respond to the government's assertion that any error in admitting Ms. Lemie's videotaped deposition was harmless in light of Mr. McGowan's own admissions at trial that he repeatedly lied to her about her investments.
Well, Your Honor, I briefly responded to that in a short reply brief. The court may be aware my time frame got moved up on it because we were set for oral argument. I was trying to get it as long as possible so I could be here in spring, but that didn't work, Judge. But
I know spring.
I did point out two things, and the first is that the critical nature of this witness to this trial is virtually immeasurable because all evidence came in through her, all interaction with Mr. McGowan came in through her. It is unlike Burns, it is unlike Donaldson, in both of which there cases there are more than one complainant making the same assertions. So I made the point in that reply brief that his need to testimony was a direct product of the manner in which her testimony came in. Now, that being said, it's part of the record. I understand the court has to consider it. But I'll make another point about that, and that is he did admit to falsity in his conversations with her. He did not admit to stealing her money. In fact, he specifically denied stealing her money. So if you exclude her testimony, as the Chapman test under harmless error tends to imply, and there's some dispute as to whether it's uniformly followed in all circuits, the take-it-out rule, so to speak, if you take it out, and if all you are left with then is his words admitting some dishonesty with her, you would have a sufficiency argument then because the essential elements of the offense would not be met.
Yeah.
So I hope that answers your question, Judge Rovner.
The videotaped deposition spanned something like 12 hours, is that right?
Right.
Which, it sort of undercuts an argument that they were not a full and thorough opportunity to cross-examine, but on the other hand, it also undercuts an argument about harmlessness.
Right. That's true, Your Honor. And certainly I would say what I said in my reply brief is that I believe the duration of the cross-examination in this case is misleading. Because of, you know, if you're going to look at that duration, it's also critically important to look at the passage of years as this case sort of loped along toward trial downstairs. In part of that goes to my sharp criticism of the absence of balance in this record as to availability. Availability, obviously, is the starting point not only under Rule 804, but in determining whether the substitute for the preferred live testimony is there. Here you have a situation where little things that could have been done, Your Honor, for over 2.5 years, counsel requested an independent medical evaluation. This followed the specific discovery of facts which refuted and contradicted her attorney's claimed limitation of her physical capacity.
What prevented counsel from taking the doctor's letters and the videotaped depositions to another physician for another opinion? I understand you wanted another, well, not you, but counsel wanted another physician to examine her, by why not seek a second opinion with the information that was already available?
Well, the problem is, first of all, I'll go back then to the word then existing medical condition, Your Honor. We certainly don't dispute that Ms. Lemie had the symptoms of diabetic ailments, which are fairly predictable but also fairly manageable, and that at a given time, in fact, Your Honor, it appears that there was some improvement in the days before this trial were to start because of the last deposition in which Ms. Lemie was observed walking instead of motorizing herself in a cart and, other things which had not been observed earlier. So my answer to that, Your Honor, is I guess in an environment where the district court just refused to, and I see my red light is on already, I came here thinking I had 15 minutes, but it was on the thing this morning, it was down to 10.
We didn't change that.
I don't know why. I thought my order said 15, but that's
wishful
okay.
Thinking.
That's okay, Your Honor. Sure, I could use 20, but I guess the point I'm making is that wouldn't have done very much good, Your Honor, given the changing nature of such conditions and the treatment availability that are there. And I guess since my light is red, I should take leave of the court at the moment.
Yes, and I will give you, some
thank you.
Short amount of time for rebuttal. Okay. Mrs. Sicilla.
Sicilla, that's correct. May it please the court, my name is Erica Sicilla. I'm here on behalf of the United States. The district court in this case carefully, fully, and timely considered whether Ms. Lemie was unavailable for live testimony at trial. The district court determined that she was not, and therefore there was no abuse of discretion in making that determination. The government in this case met its continuing burden in demonstrating unavailability. It was undisputed that Ms. Lemie was in poor physical health and that her conditions were chronic, and I think that's significant here. She suffered not just from diabetes, but from lung issues, heart issues, liver issues. She had multiple sclerosis, a whole host of issues that presented her with chronic health problems.
So why are we relying on the opinion of an eye doctor?
Dr. Sandoz was her ophthalmologist, but he's also
isn't he a neurologist, too?
He was also a neurologist, that's correct. And he was familiar with her underlying medical conditions. Also presented to the district court were declarations from her general practitioner laying out her physical ailments and also the effects that would occur or would be likely to occur if she were to testify live at trial.
What took so long to get the indictment here?
It's not in the record why there was a delay.
We've got a statute of limitations argument here, and this also may or may not have some bearing on the issue of her availability for trial, but the conversations were taped between April and July of 1998.
That's correct.
And he wasn't indicted until 2003.
That's correct. And again, it's not in the record as to why the government waited until 2003. It was within the statute of limitations. I would note that Ms. Lemie, her health conditions were evident in 1998, and that's part of the reason that she went to Mr. McGowan with her inheritance to invest her money and achieve financial security. So there's evidence in the record that she was suffering from conditions at the time that she was defrauded by Mr. McGowan.
It may not be in the record, but it is true, is it not, that the government had all the information it needed to indict shortly after she reported the crime?
I'm not aware, based on the record that I've reviewed, sort of the history of the investigation. I know that the tapes were made in 1997 and 1998. There's paperwork associated with the case, bank records, those sorts of things. And I'm not sure of the timing of when that material was received by the government. I know that the investigation was ongoing. And again, I'm also not aware specifically of sort of the charging decisions made in this case, whether or not for example, other charges were being considered, but later dropped, those sorts of things could have affected why the government delayed bringing the case.
You know, the government's argument about harmless error seems completely circular to me. How can we consider the evidence that was admitted in error in determining whether admitting that evidence was harmless. I mean, is there a single case that would support that standard?
Well, looking first at addressing your circularity question, I think the issue here is whether or not the harmless error inquiry matches what the alleged error is. And in this case, it's not that the witness's testimony was substantively improper, but rather it's the form of the testimony that was presented to the trial.
Well, it's the lack of confrontation. I mean, I thought whatever else may be true about Cannon and your compliance with Criminal Rule 15 and all the rest, if it would have violated Mr. McGowan's confrontation rights to put her testimony in through video, then we have to ask, for harmless error purposes, what if the video were never shown? I can't imagine a scenario under which we should then turn around again and take the video testimony into account. You have to say, what would this case have looked like without it? I couldn't find a single case that has done what you're talking about, and it actually is disturbing to me that the government's making this argument.
Well, I would first address that by saying, to step back for a moment and look at the defendant's confrontation rights from the perspective of the deposition itself. He sat across from the defendant.
That's an argument that Rule 15 was complied with, and that's enough to satisfy anything that the Confrontation Clause required. Perfectly good argument. You know, it's made in the government's brief, but that allows the video evidence in. That means there's no error, right, on the part of the district court to let it in.
That Rule 15 was complied
with.
Right,
right. That Rule 15, you had all these things. There was confrontation. There was cross-examination. I understand that part of your argument. But then it seems to me in your brief you move on to a what if we're wrong, you know, scenario. And on the what if you're wrong scenario, her testimony is critical, and I don't see how we can look at the evidence in the record taking into account the very evidence that should never have come in on that hypothetical assumption, which I know is not your position. I know your first position is it was fine for it to come in.
Correct, correct. Again, I would ask the court to match the harmless error inquiry to the error itself. The error here was the presentation, or the alleged error is the presentation of Ms. Lemie's testimony in video form versus live form. The Chapman standard, which is the harmless error standard, doesn't require that her testimony be dropped out substantively.
Why not? I have no idea why you say that.
Well, in part because she, I guess presuming what would happen had the court determined her, or should she have been available, she would have had to testify live at trial.
That's what didn't happen. That's what he wanted to have happened. He wanted her to travel to Chicago and sit there in the courtroom and testify.
Correct. But again, in a harmless error context, when you're looking at what the actual error was and you're balancing that with the defendant's right to confrontation, here his confrontation rights, in large, assuming that we're in the harmless error world, are largely complied with. He did have the opportunity to cross-examine her. He sat across from her, and his defense attorney cross-examined her at length, beyond as the defendant admitted in the reply brief.
Listen,
beyond.
You're urging the court to include the videotaped evidence in making the harmless error analysis. Let me tell you why that doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense because the video is the evidence that was alleged to have been admitted in error. It is a completely circular argument.
I'm not sure that I can provide an answer beyond
maybe
what I've offered
to. Better stop now.
If the court has no further questions with regard to this issue, then I think I'd rest on the briefs and ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Mrs. Sisson.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to give you another 2 minutes, even though you don't deserve it. But you came so far and in the depth of the winter.
Thank you, Your Honor. I very much appreciate it. Judge Wood, the problem I have with Cannon is that it is fraught with the potential for misuse. if it is read to be a blanket rule that all videotape depositions properly taken are admissible in lieu of live testimony, then it sets up a construct where accusers don't actually have to go to court. And what I would say to you is that although clearly there are circumstances where a videotape can survive and be admissible, and certainly within the confines of Rule 15, it is not a blanket rule. The requirement of unavailability is still an absolute necessity. The in-court face-to-face cross-examination is described by Crawford as being the crucible of the way that one tests witness statements against them. So I picked that out because we've spent a lot of time talking about harmlessness today, and I'd like to talk about the error which comes before the harmlessness.
Sure. I read Rule 15, though, you can't use it as evidence. I mean, it just says as provided by the Federal Rules of Evidence, but you couldn't use that deposition evidence without a finding of unavailability.
Right.
I mean, I think we all agree with that.
And that's why I've attempted to speak a good bit this morning on how that process is flawed, particularly given the district court's reliance upon statements such as she can't travel anywhere from her eye doctor, which turned out to be demonstrably false, such as she's confined to a wheelchair, which she turned out not always to be. And all of these things that go to the very heart of availability, both under Rule 804 and under the Rule of Confrontation, that I think Cannon doesn't singularly trump. Thank you, Your Honor.
You still have another minute.
Well, I appreciate that, Judge. Are there questions from the panel about that? Because I think it's a critical point here. I don't want to get to harmlessness, and I think there are other reasons why harmless error doesn't apply, and that is, again, looking through the jurisprudence of the Seventh Circuit, and frankly, any I found, this was essentially a trial by media. There were audio tapes played. There was a videotape played. Hamlet literally was taken from the play. To quote a sentence from the first argument I heard this morning. And what we're left with is a man sitting alone watching and listening to a number of things, an attorney that was supposedly provided his lone effective right of cross-examination, I shouldn't say lone, but his primary, over 3 years ago, and this component of availability required further action by the district court, and a simple IME would have started to accomplish that, or, heaven forbid, as in Donaldson, there's an actual evidentiary hearing contemporaneous with the start of trial. Which he also denied and tried to blame the attorney for not seeking an IME, which, of course, was mistaken. Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's a pleasure.